Here we go. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
All right, Ajahn, over to you.
Great. Okay. Okay, everyone. So we're going to talk a little bit about meditation as usual and then try it out in practice, as they say. And then we can have a bit of Dhamma discussion and Dhamma talk afterwards. That's the plan for tonight. Nothing special there, the usual kind of agenda. So meditation practice is really, in a sense, all about letting go. Yeah, the idea of being able to abandon things. And because it is when you abandon things that the mind becomes simplified, the mind becomes peaceful, the mind, you know, actually moves towards what you might call a uplifting, yeah, superior state, a state which is more attractive and something that actually all of us really recognize straight away when you see it. You know that these mental states are preferable to the mental states that we often have in our day-to-day life. So it is this ability to let go which really matters. And there is like a sequence to letting go. Yeah, you will notice that there are, you have to do things in the right sequence. This is one of the things the Buddha says. There's a nice sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, numerical discourses of the Buddha, threes. It's called the Pangsudovaka Sutta, which means the earth washer or the earth remover. Yeah, you're removing the earth from like gold to be able to purify the gold. And the mind is compared to gold. And there is a reason for that, because just like gold in the material realm is very precious to human beings, in the same way, the mind, when we deal with it in the right way, is even more precious. Yeah, I mean, gold, gold doesn't do that much for you, but the mind can really change your life entirely. So the mind is compared to gold. And there's a lot of things in that simile which are which actually work out really nicely on the Buddhist path, because gold has to be refined. Yeah, and to refine gold, you have to abandon the defilements, the impurities of gold in a certain order. You have to start out with the coarse things, yeah, like the gravel and sand or whatever. You get rid of the gravel and the sand. Then you have the kind of small defilements, and you have the microscopic defilements. And the more of the impurities that you get out of the gold, the more that gold becomes shining, brilliant, beautiful, yeah, like a real golden ornament that you buy from a goldsmith or something like that. And the mind is exactly the same according to the sutta. You have to abandon your defilements gradually. Yeah, so when you sit down, very often you just have to take a few deep breaths and just relax. That's kind of how you start off. Yeah, just get rid of some of the busyness of the day and just kind of allow that to dissipate. But once you start to settle down, once you start to feel a little bit peaceful, a little bit relaxed, once the busyness of the day starts to become a bit more distant, yeah, you kind of dropping it off into the background, it doesn't matter so much anymore, you will of course notice that there are still problems, yeah, there are still things there. And then you have to progress these things gradually, stage by stage. You know, the obvious things that you have to let go of, things like the thinking mind. This is one of the biggest problems. And with each stage of letting go, what we have to do to be enable the process of letting go is that you have to, the best way to do this is to remember why the thing that you're holding on to, why it is a problem, yeah, why it actually causes a disturbance. And then the second thing is to remember the happiness that comes from letting it go. Yeah, these are two critical things to remember. Yeah, the why something is a problem. If you understand that something is really dukkha, it is problematic, it is a disturbance in your mind, the more you understand that, the easier it is to get rid of something. Yeah. So in your life, remember that. Yeah, try to remember why. I mean, obvious things are things like just bad morality, yeah, or ill will that kind of arises every now and again. The more you understand the danger of these things, that you're kind of letting yourself down, that you are creating suffering for yourself and others, that you are building up bad qualities for the future because these things are habitual. So once you are, you know, you live and you do things that are immoral, you're creating habits, you're creating kind of pathways in the brain or whatever. And then it becomes harder to let it go. So the more you understand all of these downsides, the easier it is to let go when you have to let go. And these are things worthy of reflection in daily life. As you go about your business, yeah, whatever that might be, your work or in your family life or whatever it is that you do, have these things at the back of your mind, yeah, so that you always contemplate. You have kind of things you can contemplate in daily life, rather than making daily life just about business. Make it more spiritual in this kind of particular sense. And then, as it sinks in why these things are problematic, then when it comes time to sit down on a meditation cushion, and you find that your mind is thinking about the future. Yeah, think whatever it might be, or thinking about the past, because you know that future you're thinking about, actually, it is not that interesting. Yeah, that future that you're thinking about is very often just more of the same. It is solving problems that have no end. There will be more problems again in the future. It is the world of the five senses. And the world of the five senses is basically that whole world out there that you read about, on the, you see on the news, you read about in the paper or the internet or whatever, all the political instability, all the climate change, all the refugee crisis, whatever it is, that is the world of the five senses. The world of the five senses is not just kind of what you are experiencing now. It's that whole gamut of things, yeah, in that world outside. And, you know, you hear about people who have climate change anxiety and who have all kind of anxiety about where the world is going. And sometimes I think, yeah, there's good reasons for having a bit of anxiety about all this stuff. Yeah, you can see why people have that problem. I mean, I'm not really surprised at all. But at the same time, it is what it teaches you from a Buddhist point of view, that that world is out of control. Yeah. And it actually enhances your spiritual path because it reminds you that this, what you're doing now, this is what matters. This is what will secure you a good future. Because by building up spiritual qualities within, that is how we secure the future. Not through trying to control the outer world. So you can let go of that outer world a little bit. And when you let go of the outer world, when it becomes less interesting, it means that you don't think about it. Yeah, because the future we think about is always the future in the outer world. If that outer world is not interesting, you just stop thinking about it. So this is what I mean by understanding the suffering, yeah, the problem in that sense world of sensory experience. And that helps you to let go a little bit of that world. It also means that you don't think so much about the past. Yeah, sometimes we think about the past and we think about the good old days, yeah, all the good old days. Yeah, everything was so marvelous in the good old days. You see the good old days with rose-tinted glasses, but the good old days weren't that great. It's just a mirage. It's a kind of a trick of memory that makes us think that the old days were good. It's like a photo album. Yeah, when you have a photo album like we had, you know, back in the 1980s. I don't know if you have these photo albums anymore, but. And my father, he was an expert, you know, he had these photo albums from the 1960s and he would draw, yeah, he'd make his own drawings and he would write under the pictures and kind of tell the story and the pictures would be there. And in those pictures, they were always beautiful pictures, yeah, always the best pictures that you pick out. Everyone is smiling, everyone is cheery, everyone is happy. And what it does, it creates an illusion about the past. The past is not like the photo album. The photo album is like a cherry-picked idea of the past. It is not actually reality. And our memories work a little bit like photo albums. The things that we remember are often the good things. Unless you have been traumatized. If you have a trauma from the past, it will stay with you. But apart from that, we often think of the good things in the past. And in a sense, that's good because we don't want to carry the negative ideas with us. But if we attach to it, if we hold on to it, then you may actually end up thinking about it as well. And that becomes problematic in that case. So let that go too. Yeah, let go of the past. It is not what you think it was. We have no idea what the past really was. And then that whole world of past and future fades away because you understand the inherent unreliability of that whole world of the five senses. And it's beautiful, yeah. People think this is scary because they think that it means that you lose connection to that world, you lose connection to your family and friends and all of these kind of things. But it is not scary if you do it in the right way. If you do it gently, it is a very beautiful process. It allows you to come into the present. Not the present moment, but the present. Present moment is not a term you find in the suttas. You come into the present, and then you find real meaning in your life, and you create happiness. You create something here and now that you will bring into the future, and that is how you secure the future. And then come climate change, come political stability, come whatever. You have resources within yourself to be able to deal with almost anything because you have something within you which is very powerful and useful. So use some of these simple techniques to enable your meditation practice. Yeah, remember where real happiness is to be found. Remember where suffering is to be found. Make that distinction and understand how it works. And as you understand that, you will be able to hopefully let go a little bit more easily. Letting go is not just something we do. There is a particular process behind it. And this is part of that process. Anyway, enough talking. Let's do some meditation together here. Okay, everyone, so just start out your meditation as you normally do, just by relaxing and just allowing things to be, not trying to meditate, but allowing the peace to come to you instead. And when you do allow the peace to arise, and you don't do anything to make it happen, the meditation tends to become very delightful. It is delightful because it is automatic. You can just sit back, relax, watch, and enjoy the whole process happen all by itself. And as you go along, just allow the world to fade into the background. And you will notice that there is always something in the present that is peaceful. There's some peace available there at all times. So just dwell on that peace. Enjoy that peace. Feel the sense of delight in letting go of the world just for half an hour. And what a wonderful thing it is to leave the world behind and just allow the mind to grow into the present, to allow mindfulness to become strong, gradually, stage by stage. And if you find that your mind is a bit busy thinking about the past or the future or fantasizing or whatever it is, just very gently, with kindness, remind yourself that the future is not made by thinking about it. There is no solution through thinking. The solution comes through practicing the spiritual life, which means right now just remaining in the present, enjoying the simplicity, the mindfulness, just being with your breath, having a sense of gentle perspective on yourself and all other beings. And as you do that, that is where you create everything that can be created. And so then you let go of the task of trying to control the future, and you allow yourself to develop the mind right here. Okay, so we are coming close to the end. Before we come to the end, just take a few moments just to reflect back on the meditation here, and ask yourself whether you feel more peaceful or less peaceful or whatever. And if you do feel more peaceful, ask yourself why that is the case. Try to understand how the meditation works. Okay, everyone, so there you are. Before we go on to the talk, are there any questions or comments or anything anyone would like to make? Anything about meditation practice? Please don't be afraid of asking very simple questions. The simple questions are often the most relevant ones. I think often they are the ones that other people are thinking about as well, but don't dare to ask because they think they, you know what it's like with these things. So please feel very, very free to ask any questions that comes to mind.
John, we do have one question in the chat.
Please.
That Rupeksha has posted. She's asked me if it's possible to ask you to talk about the Sutta 111 in Majjhima Nikaya, and especially in relation to the first jhana.
Okay. Yes, that sutta is called the Anupada Sutta. And it is an interesting sutta, but sometimes it is interesting for all the wrong reasons, unfortunately. And that sutta has a lot of Abhidhamma influence on it. It has, if you look at it very carefully, there's a lot of kind of strange things in that sutta. It's one of the strangest suttas in the entire Majjhima Nikaya, middle-length sayings of the Buddha. And I think I would recommend you, instead of me looking at that sutta in detail during the Armadeha group, it's quite a technical thing that is required to understand the sutta. I would recommend that you go to the BSWA website and you look at the sutta discussions we have there and see if you can find that sutta. I think I have done it in the past and I think I have pointed out all the kind of strange phenomena with that sutta and the influence from the Abhidhamma and all of these kind of things, which actually makes that sutta not so interesting for understanding the jhanas. It looks like it is interesting for understanding the jhanas because it adds a lot of material, but actually that material comes from the Abhidhamma, and I don't think it is as interesting as the sutta material. So try that first of all, see if you can find it on the BSWA website. And if you can't, let me know at some point. And then maybe we can discuss it a little bit at some point later on. Maybe I can do it at Dhammaloka or whatever.
Thank you, Ajahn. So does anyone have any questions or comments they would like to ask Ajahn? This is a wonderful opportunity.
I do, Fred.
Oh, lovely, good. I thought you might. That's wonderful. Okay.
Thank you. So, hello, Ajahn Ramali and everyone. Ajahn Ramali, thank you so much for your wisdom and your guidance and always your humor. And I have a comment and a question. So today during the meditation, I found I was able to be more warm and and friendly with myself when I caught my thoughts going other places. And I noticed that my breathing was different. You know, when I, oh, look, my thoughts are somewhere future, wherever, off on some tangent. I noticed my breathing, where I was breathing changed, the rapidity of it. And that was nice, and I was able to be more warm and friendly with myself and guiding myself out of that. My question is about piti, and I've read the Bhikkhu Bodhi has translated it as a zestful interest.
Okay.
And I know it used the word rapture. And, you know, rapture has its own world around it, that word, anyway, culturally. But I'm interested in this zestful interest, and I know it's in the Anapanasati, but I was wondering if you could talk about that, because I like this interest in the breath, in the meditation,
yeah,
in everyday life. So I'm wondering if this makes sense, and if you could talk about that a bit, about PT, about interest in where it fits in with the right mindfulness, with awareness,
yeah,
and in meditation now.
Okay, yeah, sure. So the interest, you know, in meditation practice, it comes from the delighting in the object, because the object becomes very delightful. Yeah, and this is kind of the idea of all of these qualities when you read the Anapanasati Sutta, or you read the factors of awakening, or you have the dependent liberation sequence. It all has a similar kind of factors. There's piti, there's pasadi, which is calm, and there's sukha, which is the profound happiness that comes beyond that. And all of these things, they are very delightful. Yeah, they draw you into the experience. And so that is where a lot of the interest in meditation comes from. It comes from the delight in meditation. I don't think the word piti itself implies interest. Yeah, it doesn't imply that you're interested in it. I think that is something that is added, maybe added by the commentaries, or it's true in the sense that you are drawn to it, but it's not actually implied in the word. And if you look at how piti is described, and the description in the suttas, unfortunately, is not very much. It just makes it clear that it is nice and happy. But if you go to the Visuddhimagga, you find a lot of descriptions of piti. It is, you know, the seven kinds of piti, and rapturing piti, and showering piti, and all of these kind of things. But very often it is felt as a physical feeling. Yeah, you can feel it in the body. The whole body starts to feel very delightful, and it can feel like currents going through the body or something like that. So I think the word rapture, to my mind, even though, as you say, it has a lot of cultural connotations, especially in Christianity. Yeah? Christianity is very, very, the idea of rapture is very big. But I think the idea, the kind of root meaning of the word, if you shed it of its Christian connotations and look at just the root meaning of the word, it actually is very close to the idea of piti. Because rapture is precisely this kind of almost like a wave of pleasure that can go through the body, coming purely from the meditation experience itself. Zest, I must admit, I'm a little bit unsure now what the precise definition of zest actually is. So it's a bit hard for me to comment on it. Let me see if I can just very quickly check out how it is defined, because that will give me a little bit more of ability to comment on this. So zest is like enthusiasm, relish, okay? Yeah? This is straight from, taken from the Oxford Dictionary, I think. Eagerness, yeah. Zeal, excitement, verb, delight. Yeah, so I mean, zest is, you know, comes very close to what this is about as well, you know. So it is certainly kind of, you know, ballpark. Yeah. So I would say that, to my mind, I would say, in to sum it up, is that rapture comes the closest to the actual meaning, but zestful interest would be an implication of that rapture, of that piti. That's how I would summarize it. Yeah. Okay. So, Chris, anything else?
One small question, Rajan.
Yeah. Hi, Catherine. Yeah.
You mentioned, you distinguished between present moment and present.
Yeah.
And I thought you didn't do that by accident. What was that about?
Well, what that is about is that the Buddhist tradition has this idea of, the Abhidhamma idea, where we kind of try to atomize the whole world. We atomize the world, first of all, into mental and physical phenomena. And we try to, that's the kind of the whole idea of the Abhidhamma. But it also atomizes time. So you have atomic units of time. And these are called moments in the Abhidhamma. Kana is the technical term used in the Abhidhamma. And this is actually foreign from the sutta. The suttas don't have this idea of momentary experiences. And in a sense, if you are in the present and you're going with the flow, there's no sense of moments. There's a sense of flowing through time. You're always present. The idea is to be present. The idea is not to kind of see moments of time as such. So when we have mindfulness, you try to flow with experience rather than try to kind of atomize it into kind of individual units of time. And I think this is one of those important distinctions that you can, where you can distinguish between what I would call early Buddhism, which is the Buddhism that you find in the four Nikayas, compared to traditional Buddhism, which is the evolved Buddhism that you find in the commentaries and the Abhidhamma and all of that. And I think to me, the idea of just being present is much nicer. It has a beautiful flow to it, around this idea of, trying to kind of cut everything down to a kind of moments or whatever. Yeah. Okay. Yes. So,
John.
Yes?
If you would like to continue with your talk, I'm sure people would be most interested in hearing. Continue if you would like.
Yeah, sure. So, I'd be very happy to do that, of course. Is it possible for me to share my screen with people, Chris?
Yes, that is something that I think that Marlene can help us with.
Can I?
Marlene, are you able to?
I can just give it a chop and see if it works. Would that be all right? Yeah, it works. There I am. I've already done it. Yeah. So no worries, as they say. That's what they say over here anyway.
Well, we say it here too.
Is that it? Everyone says no worries these days. The Australian idiom is kind of taking over the world, I think, which is kind of nice. Okay, everyone. So what I thought I would do, I sometimes it's nice to have a framework for a talk. And this, I thought I would use a little sutta. This is a sutta that you probably haven't seen before. Well, some of you may have seen it, but I think it's quite unlikely. And this is taken from a very beautiful collection called the Sutta Nipata, which is one of those small collections found in the Kudaka Nikaya, which is the small collection of suttas. And this is a particularly ancient verse. These verses are talked about elsewhere in the sutta, so we know that they are kind of integrated with the whole broader sutta idea. Yeah, and that is why they are of special interest, because they are clearly fairly ancient. And this particular sutta is a sutta where the Buddha talks about his own experience. And I love the suttas where the Buddha talks about his own experience, he talks about his own life, because these are obviously examples to be followed. Yeah, these are the ways that the Buddha says, this is how I saw the world, I understood the world with right view in a certain way. And because of that, I was able to find this thing he calls awakening and wake up to the reality of the world. And I find these autobiographical suttas of the Buddha very, very powerful. And there's a fair number of them, but there are some that are very obscure and some that you probably have never heard about. And this is one of these that is a little bit obscure and you may not have heard about before. So I wanted to read out, it's a poem, by the way, this is all in verse. And one of the things that I certainly like prose a lot, because prose is often very precise. Yeah, the Buddha gives a very precise teaching, 7 awakening factors, and he defines them and he explains them. And this is all very useful. But verse is often more inspirational. And one of the very important things about the Dhamma is that it should have 2 aspects. It should be about understanding the teaching, so we know what we're doing. Yeah, piti, pasaddi, sukha, all these kind of things. But it should also be something to inspire us, something that elevates us, lifts us up. Yeah, and when we feel uplifted and inspired, that is when we will have success in the meditation practice. So the Dhamma should have this twofold ability. And verse is often not so interesting for precise doctrinal statements about what Buddhism is about, but it is often very useful to lift us up, yeah, and to make us inspired. That's kind of the purpose of verse, whether it's in Pali or in English or in French or in German or in American. I'm not sure if that's a separate language yet, but in Norwegian, yeah, whatever the language is, it is inspiring to read verse. And this is the same thing in Pali. So let me, I want to read this whole poem out to you with all the verses in it. And then I will go back to the beginning and I will explain some of the things that I find very interesting about this particular poem. So this poem is called Taking Up Arms, yeah, or Taking Up Violence, maybe is another way of translating this. And I noticed there's something has gone slightly wrong here, but never mind. So taking up violence or taking up arms. Let me just read through this particular poem. So this is what the Buddha speaking. Yeah, peril stems from those who take up violence. Just look at people in conflict. I shall extol how I came to be stirred with a sense of urgency. I saw this population flounder like a fish in a little puddle. Seeing them fight each other, fear came upon me. The world around was hollow. All directions were in turmoil. Wanting a home for myself, I saw nowhere unsettled. But even in their settlement, they fight. Seeing that, I grew uneasy. Then I saw a dart there, so hard to see, stuck in the heart. When struck by that dart, you run about in all directions. But when that same dart has been plucked out, you neither run about nor sink down. Whatever attachments there are in the world, don't pursue them. Having pierced through sensual pleasures in every way, train yourself for nibbana, or for quenching. Be truthful, not rude, free of deceit and rid of slander. Without anger, a sage would cross over the evils of greed and avarice. Prevail over sleepiness, sloth and drowsiness. Don't abide in negligence. A person intent on nibbana or quenching would not stand for arrogance. Don't be led into lying or get caught up in fondness for form. Completely understand conceit and desist from hasty conduct. Don't relish the old or welcome the new. Don't grieve for what is running out or get attached to things that pull you in. Greed, I say, is the great flood, and longing is the current. The basis, the compulsion, the swamp of sensuality, so hard to get past. The sage never strays from the truth. The Brahman stands firm on the shore. Having given up everything, they are said to be at peace. They have truly known, they are a knowledge master. Understanding the teaching, they are independent. They rightly proceed in the world, not coveting anything here. One who has crossed over sensuality here, the snare in the world so hard to get past, grieves not nor hopes. They've cut the strings, they're no longer bound. What came before, let it wither away, and after, let there be nothing. If you don't grasp at the middle, you will live at peace. One who has no sense of ownership in the whole realm of name and form does not grieve for that which is not. They suffer no loss in the world. If you don't think of anything as belonging to yourself or others, not finding anything to be mine, you won't grieve, thinking, I don't have it. Not bitter, not fawning, unstirred, everywhere even. When asked about one who is unshakable, I declare that that is the benefit. For the unstirred who understand, there is no permanence of deeds. Desisting from instigation, they see sanctuary everywhere. A sage doesn't speak of themselves as being among superiors, inferiors, or equals. Peaceful, rid of stinginess, they neither take nor reject. So that is the a little poem for you. You can see it's actually a very profound poem. It starts off fairly simply, but the last half, the last two-thirds, is actually very, very profound, and it's really just a declaration of what it means to be an arahant, a fully awakened being. It's profound, but I think the very first part of it is a part that I like a lot. I want to spend a little bit of time just looking at the very first part. Let's go back to the beginning again here. So here we have the Buddha, and he is talking about what gave him a sense of urgency. And it's very fascinating, because what you will see here is that the things that gave the Buddha a sense of urgency is exactly the same thing that tends to stir us up in the present day. The things that we are worried about in the world, the things that are problematic with the world, And if we deal with those things in the way the Buddha dealt with them, they will also give us a sense of urgency, a sense of the importance of the spiritual path, a sense of the importance of actually the world just isn't that interesting because the world is so inherently problematic. This is kind of the idea here. And it's the Buddha seeing this. I think that's kind of awesome, because the Buddha is this sort of... he just has such an amazing personality. The Buddha is like, he is the... In the Buddhist circles, we kind of put the Buddha quite rightly on a very, very high pedestal. And yet the Buddha experiences the world in exactly the same way that we experience the world. So you can really learn something from this. So he starts off here by seeing the violence in the world. The peril stems from those who take up violence. Just look at people in conflict. How the world... how it is inherent to the world, the idea of violence, the idea of conflict, the idea of war, the idea of people not getting on together. This is inherent in the world. And the Buddha, this is what he's talking about here. And when he sees that, then he gets this sense of urgency overcoming him. So he talks about the population floundering. How we are always... kind of thrashing about. We are living in a society which is always restless, always agitated, and we are all kind of there's this kind of problem, like a fish in a small puddle. We have this little planet together, and we're kind of all thrashing about on this planet, moving about, ever agitated, ever restless, always not, but without finding a solution. We don't find any way out. The whole planet is infected by the same problem. And that's why we're all floundering in our little fish pond, which is called the planet Earth. So this is kind of the problem. There is no, if you are an ordinary person, there isn't any path out of this. The planet is all we have. And there is no obvious solution to that problem of floundering and thrashing about and being agitated and violence and all of these kind of things. And this is the problem. So the Buddha says, seeing all of these people fighting with each other. And fighting here means not just fighting in a literal sense, but it means fighting in terms of how we speak to each other, how we think about each other. Yeah, this whole thing that we just cannot seem to get on. Yeah, one nation against another one, one neighborhood against another one, one family member against another family member. When we see this, the Buddha says, fear came upon me. And it's interesting. Yeah, here we have the greatest spiritual master in human history. To me, there's no doubt that the Buddha stands out among all spiritual teachers. The Buddha is kind of supreme. And you probably would say, I would say that because I'm a Buddhist monk. But I think, you know, there's something about the sutta that brings out that out in a very, very powerful way. And the greatest spiritual master in human history, when he sees the human condition, he becomes fearful. That's really powerful, right? This is really powerful. Here is someone you would expect to have the ability, the personal resources, the inner strength to deal with this thing. If anyone can deal with this, it would have to be the Buddha to be. He's not the Buddha yet at this point, but still, he obviously has very powerful personal qualities to enable him to later on become the Buddha. So he becomes fearful. Yeah, and if he becomes fearful because he sees that we are all trapped in this cycle, everlasting cycle of violence that's going on and on and on, well, then there is good reason for us too to be a little bit anxious about the world, yeah? To understand, you know, we can start to understand why it is that people have a bit of anxiety about the world. These days, whether we call it climate anxiety, you call it political anxiety, whatever you call it, it kind of makes sense, yeah? Because the world really is out of control. We are all floundering, we're thrashing about, not finding solutions, just fighting each other over and over and over. Look at human history, it hasn't changed at all, and it's still happening here. So this is the beauty, and this is kind of the idea here of having this sense of urgency that arises out of this, seeing the world being out of control, being so inherently problematic, that gives the spiritual path profound value for each and every one of us when we see that, because we understand. We don't despair so much about the world anymore because we know there is an alternative way out. And we use that way out and get a sense of urgency about that path. So the Buddha continues. The world around was hollow. Yeah, there is no essence to that world. There is no stability in that world. There's nothing you can hold on to in that world, which is, you know, where you can kind of set down your foot and you can relax. And now I have stability. All directions are in turmoil. It's like the whole world is shaking. The whole world is trembling. As soon as you try to get a foothold somewhere, the turmoil of the world, the shaking of the world, makes you fall over. Yeah, there is nowhere in that world you can have a foothold. It's always changing. And you can see that. I'm sure you can see that in your own life. Every time you read something or you see something that upsets you in the world, yeah, why are they doing this? Why can't the world get their act together? Why can't we solve the problems? Yeah, we're all humans. We have the ability if we really want to. Yeah, and sometimes it can be upsetting that we cannot solve the obvious problems that we have in our world. But it seems to be our human condition that sometimes we can, sometimes we can't. We seem to have a problem working together in resolving the issues of the world. Yeah, this just seems to be the way it is. So look at what happens when you see the world and you feel a sense of despair. And the reason you feel that despair, the reason you get upset, is because you're trying to find an essence. You're trying to find something to hold on to in the world where there is nothing to hold on to. It is hollow. There's nothing there which is stable. Everything, all directions are in turmoil. That is the problem. And then you can gradually withdraw a little bit from that world. So I'm not saying this because I want you to despair about the world. I'm saying this for the exact opposite reason. I'm saying it because we should be so glad that we have a spiritual path. We have an alternative. That is why I'm saying this. So, you know, find that balance for yourself in rejecting on the one hand and in moving somewhere else on the other. Don't try to move too fast because it will just hurt you. But be aware that there is that transition that can be made gradually, gradually, gradually. Moving away from the world, moving on to the spiritual path instead. And then the Buddha says, wanting a home for myself. This is what we want. Yeah, we want somewhere where we can find something reliable, something we can hold on to. We need that. It's very hard to have a life when there's nothing to hold on to. It becomes almost impossible. And of course, that's why we have the triple gem. The triple gem is the refuge, yeah, that becomes the home of a Buddhist, if you like. So you have something that you can kind of rely on. And what you can rely on are the laws of the spiritual path, the laws of things like dependent origination and those kind of things. So you have something that you can, works for you in this world. But here the Buddha hasn't come to this point yet. So he says, wanting a home for myself, I saw nowhere unsettled. The idea here, unsettled here, means something unsettled means a place which is stable, a place where you can settle down and feel good and hold on and you're okay. So nowhere unsettled means that everything is in turmoil. There's another way of saying everything is in turmoil. Everything is unreliable. Everything is uncertain. Yeah, there is nowhere to find a home in this world. We need to look somewhere else. And then the Buddha to be says, but even in their settlement, they fight. So even when they try to settle down, they fight. Seeing that, I grew uneasy. Yeah, so it's basically the same thing again. Then I saw a dart there, so hard to see, stuck in the heart. So here the Buddha is now moving towards the solution to the problem. So the very first part here of this verse is really setting out the problem. It is an aspect of right view. Yeah, this is what the right view is. The Buddha is getting clarity about what the world is like. And then as that clarity becomes stronger, he has more clarity about what is going on, then he looks for the solution. Yeah, and that solution here is the seeing the dart in the heart. This is also part of the right view, yeah, seeing the dart. And then, of course, you also start to find the solution, because once you see the dart, then, of course, you know roughly what you have to do. So what is this dart? And, of course, the dart in the heart is the craving. Yeah, because the craving is the thing that kind of that drives us on in the world. The craving is what makes us be violent. The craving is what causes clashes in the world. Craving is what causes us to be attached to the world and keeps us running around after things that never really give rise to any real happiness or peace or anything like that. So that is the problem. That gives rise to everything else that is problematic in the world. And this is a very interesting idea. I always found this very fascinating. One of the suttas that I read out recently on one of the retreats we were doing, and we're talking about the devas in particular, the gods, and how they, how some of the teachings to the gods are very interesting. Now, one of the most interesting and most profound teachings to the gods is called the Sakkapanya Sutta, which means the questions to Sakka. Sakka is the kind of head god of one of the heavenly realms. And in that sutta, this god Sakka, this deva Sakka, he goes to the Buddha. And it's a very interesting story, this whole story. I can't talk about that now because we only have a few minutes left. And then he asks the Buddha, he says to the Buddha, why is it? And this is such a good question. It's a really, really good question. He says, well, why is it that when humanity, when all beings want to live in peace, they want to live in non-violence, they want to live in harmony with each other, we want all of these things, and yet We live in violence. We live with war. We live with people taking up weapons. How come there is this discrepancy between how we actually live and how we want to live? What is going on here? Yeah, and this is so fascinating. And then the Buddha goes through a sequence of causes and bringing it back down to the very basic problem of why this is happening here. But the simple answer is that when we live in the sensory realm, when we are part of the sensory world, that sensory world is inherently problematic. When you live in the sensory world, there is always going to be conflict. There's always going to be people rubbing up against each other. There's going to be problems in that world. Why? Well, because the sensory realm is the world outside. And the world outside is something we share. And because we share it, we're going to fight over it. There's only so much resources. Everyone wants more resources. There's only so many partners to be had in the world. We want the same girlfriends and boyfriends. We want the same promotions. We want the same money. We want the same material things, the same house, the same whatever. And because of this, there's going to be inherent conflict in that world. And to me, that is a very powerful statement. Because what that statement means is that this world of ours is so flawed. Yeah, it is flawed at a very fundamental level. And this is exactly what the Buddha is saying here. Yeah, the idea of people floundering, yeah, in the little pond we call the earth. And because they are floundering in that pond that we kind of, the society that we try to live together in, always fighting each other, not being able to extricate themselves from that problem. And the reason they cannot extricate themselves is because this is the nature of this society. The only way to extricate yourself is through the spiritual practice. It's from an internal change, not an external change. And this is the power of the spiritual path. When struck by that dart, you run about in all directions. Yeah, the dart of craving makes you run around the whole world. Without craving, you become very peaceful and still. But craving makes you do things. Yeah, this is the kind of the root culprit of all the agency and all the doing and trying to achieve things in the world. But when that same dart has been plucked out, you neither run about nor sink down. Yeah, you stop the running about in the world, nor do you sink down. And sink down here can maybe be understood to mean that you don't get any heavy emotions, perhaps. You don't grieve so much anymore. You don't get depressed about things. All the heavy emotions of life also gets plucked out at the same time. You become more joyful character, yeah? And this is what you see in people who have practiced the path for a long time. That's exactly what you see. You see more joy, you see more equanimity, more ability to deal with the problems in the world. So this is the right view, yeah? And so then he continues a little bit more about this right view. I only have a couple of minutes left, so I'm going to go fairly quickly through what is left here. Whatever attachments there are in the world, you don't pursue them. If you see that the world is problematic, you're no longer so interested in that world. Having pierced through the sensual pleasures in every way, in other words, having understood what they are, you train yourself for quenching. Quenching is just another word for nibbana, yeah, for the giving up of interest in those things. You're moving away from all of the things in the world because you understand their downside. So that is the kind of the background. That is the right view. And now comes more kind of ordinary Dhamma, if you like, that you see many other places. And these are really just aspects of the path. Yeah, and I don't need to comment so much on this, or I could, but there's no time, so I will just kind of read through it very quickly just to give an idea of what is happening here. Yeah, so you'll be truthful, not rude, free from deceit, rid of slander. Without anger, a sage would cross over the evils of greed and avarice. Prevail over the sleepiness, sloth, and drowsiness. don't abide in negligence. Yeah, negligence here means like not being circumspect or not thinking properly about things. A person intent on quenching or nibbana would not stand for arrogance. Arrogance being another defilement of the mind, of course. Yeah, more about lying and don't get caught into the fondness for form. This is really about, you know, the fondness that we have for all the beautiful things in the world. Very often that means other people, especially someone we want to have as a partner. We see them and we are very taken in by physical form in that sense, yeah? But it also means all other physical form in the world. So this is kind of a small, if you like, refinement on the kind of normal way of thinking about desire, etc. Completely understand conceit, desist from hasty conduct. Yeah, this adds little things that you don't normally see on the Buddhist path of practice. Yeah, this idea, don't have hasty conduct. That's a really beautiful one. We are circumspect, we are careful, we think about how we act. We try to avoid being impulsive. When you are impulsive, usually it is okay, but sometimes your defilements come out through impulsiveness. And then, of course, it can be very problematic. Don't relish the old or welcome the new. Don't hold on to the past. Don't grieve for what is running out or get attached to things that pull you in. Greed, I say, is the great flood. The desire in the mind is kind of this flood that is always carrying on, always moving forward. The moment desire comes to an end, then if you become peaceful, it's as if the flood kind of stops in that sense. The longing is the current, and there's a swamp of sensuality so hard to get past. The Buddhist suttas are very confronting, the swamp of sensuality. For most people, this is kind of incomprehensible. But from a Buddhist point of view, this is the trap of sensuality, the trap of the sensory realm, where we are held down, we are held low, we are lesser beings because of the sensual realm. And you will notice in your own mind that the more peaceful you become, the more real joy you have, etc., etc., you're rising out of the sensory world. And when you rise out of the sensory world, that is where real meditation happens. So I will stop there because I think I have made the points anyway of the most important aspects of the sutta. So I apologize for not being able to finish it off, but I think we have seen what really is the most interesting part of it. So there you are. So marvelous to see you all.